Welcome to Switchblade Sisters, where women get together to slice and dice our favorite action and genre films. I'm film critic April Wolf. Every week, I invite a new female filmmaker on, a writer, director, actor, producer, and we talk in depth about one of their fave genre films, perhaps one that influenced their own work in some strange way. And today, I'm very excited to have director Sandy Tan with me. Hi, Sandy.
Hi, April. Oh, that was very froggy. Hi, April.
There you go. All right. Welcome to the show now. So for those of you who are less familiar with Sandy's work, please allow me to introduce her. Born in Singapore, Sandy published a zine called The Exploding Cat at 16. And at 22, she became the film critic at The Straits Times, Singapore's largest newspaper. Is it still the largest newspaper?
It is, I guess. I don't follow these things, but...
I'm sure you still have a legion of fans who are wondering what happened.
They're
to
all
your
12 years old, so you might be, I don't know, older now, but yeah.
Then she threw all that away to run off to film school at Columbia University. Her short films Movable Feast and Gourmet Baby have played at over 100 film festivals, including the New York Film Festival, Clermont-Ferrand, and MoMA, as well as broadcast internationally on RAI, SBS, and ZDF Art. She is also the author of The Black Isle from Hachette, an epic novel that reimagines Singapore's 20th century as a ghost story. The novel has been translated into Dutch, Turkish, and Polish. Her writing has also appeared in LA Weekly, The New York Times, Savoir, and elsewhere. Sandy most recently wrote, directed, and produced, and co-edited Shirkers, which won the World Cinema Documentary Directing Award after its Sundance 2018 premiere. It was picked up as a Netflix original documentary and was on the shortlist for the 2019 Best Documentary Academy Award. Shirkers reconstructs the story of an unfinished feature film Sandy made as a teenager with her friends, using actual footage from the film combined with personal interrogations exploring how exactly the film came to be before it went missing. The film has since won many awards, including the Los Angeles Film Critics Award for Best Documentary, and is one of the nominees for Best Documentary at the 2019 Independent Spirit Awards. The film has also appeared on multiple Best Documentary and Film Festival and Best Film lists of 2018, including the LA Times, The New Yorker, and was ranked number 14, tied with Corrieta's Shoplifters and Wells' The Other Side of the Wind, on the 2018 BFI Sight and Sound Best Film poll of 264 international critics. So, Sandy, that's a lot of acclaim for one film.
Yeah.
She was looking at the floor the whole time
read. No, I'm going to be looking at the floor the entire time.
Oh, good, good. That's just your opinion, your feeling at this point going through the process.
It's the way I respond to things. I look at the floor.
Well, yeah, just get your bearings. Sandy,
yes.
Today, the film that you chose to talk about with me is Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me.
Yes.
And I was hoping that you could tell me a little bit about why you chose that.
Okay. I try to watch this movie every year. It's the most, I don't know, it's the most intense movie that kind of...
Every year, though?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I know. Well, every year in the last maybe 10 years.
Okay.
Not that long. Not since it came out.
Yeah.
Because it was hard to get, yeah. I guess. It's now on a Criterion Blu-ray, so it's a wonderful edition that you can actually, you know, rent or, I don't know, you can watch it on the Criterion channel now, yeah. I guess. But it's a movie that just moved me deeply when I saw it, and I didn't really know how to process it. It's taken me multiple viewings, many, many years to realize. And actually, I had this revelation last year, actually. No, actually 2 years ago when I was making Shirkers. I was editing Shirkers in 2017. And I realized that, and that's the year that the Twin Peaks season 3, The Return, was
yes.
aired as well.
Yeah.
And the original Fire Walk With Me was made in 1992.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the story that it charts the last final days of Laura Palmer before she gets murdered, right?
Yeah,
and
then everything leading up.
Yeah,
into,
everything yeah. leading up to that. So it's kind of like the prequel for the Twin Peaks TV series that was aired before that. So it fucks with time anyway. It's like the prequel that comes after Twin Peaks is aired. And what I realized was that 1992 was the year I made Shirkers, and 2017 was the year I revisited the making of Shirkers when it was in the edit. And it's the same fucking 25 years. It's the same 25 years that, you know, because in season 3 of Twin Peaks, Laura Palmer, played by Cheryl Lee, comes back almost like a ghost to kind of revisit her old home. And that episode just like made my, I mean, my flesh crawl. It was like, that was revisiting horror. I mean, like a person coming back to see, to kind of investigate the site of a murder almost. Mm-hmm. And, you know, me seeing that 25 years later, having, you know, aged as well, like Cheryl Lee, I was no longer a teenager. And just feeling like I was revisiting my death, you know, with this, the theft of Shirkers the first time in 1982.
We should say that Shirkers, the footage was stolen.
Yeah.
By the director.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we probably should rewind a little bit and say what the film is about.
But this is
why it just like it just, you know, hit me 2 years ago that, oh my God, this is why I couldn't express what the kinship I felt for this thing exactly was. But then I realized 2 years ago that this was it. And you know, in fact, like Twin Peaks, the Return was all about aging and dealing with time and, mm-hmm. and feeling out of space and out of time. And I think there's no better filmmaker that captures that than David Lynch, you know?
Yeah. And for those of you who haven't seen Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me, today's episode is obviously going to give you some spoilers, but that shouldn't stop you from listening before you watch. As always, my motto is that it's not what happens, but how it happens that makes a movie worth watching. Still, if you would like to pause this and watch Fire Walk With Me first, this is your chance. Now let's introduce Fire Walk With Me with a quick synopsis. Written by Bob Engel and David Lynch and directed by Lynch, Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me tells the story of Laura Palmer leading up to that fateful night of her murder. But it doesn't begin with Laura. Instead, it begins with FBI agents Chester Desmond and Sam Stanley investigating a different murder a year earlier. The dead woman is missing a ring and has a letter under her fingernail, a callback to the murder of Laura Palmer.
What is it?
It's a piece of white paper with the letter T imprinted on it. Come here, take a look.
When Chester finds the ring, he reaches for it and is taken by an unseen force. Okay, so then Dale Cooper enters the picture. He's sent to investigate the missing agent after another long-lost agent, Philip Jeffries, shows up talking about a portal to another world. Okay. All of this, don't even worry about
it's,
that.
Yeah, because it's 35 minutes before she, before Laura Palmer actually shows up.
Yes, and then 1 year later, mm-hmm. right? So we got 1 year later, and we finally see the sign for Twin Peaks, and we finally get a little bit of our music. So we return to Twin Peaks. Laura's hanging out with Donna and flirts with both Bobby and James, you know, just how we would assume that she would. She also does bumps of coke in the bathroom and then later on realizes that pages have been torn out from her diary, all of this fitting in with the TV show. She tells her agoraphobic friend Harold about all of this stuff, but cryptically tells him she might not be coming back.
I don't know when I can come back. Maybe never.
Then a woman and her masked son warn Laura that Bob is in her room. But the only person she sees when she goes to check in her room is her father, Leland. Oh, no. That night, Leland is a fucking creep to her and weird about having dirty fingers.
Oh, these hands are filthy. Look. There's dirt way under this fingernail.
Laura then has a fucked up dream about the Black Lodge and Annie Blackburn telling her that the good Cooper is stuck in the Black Lodge. She doesn't even know who the hell Cooper is. She holds a ring in her hand when she wakes up, but when she's really awake, it's actually gone out of her hand. So Laura goes to a bar later to make some money by having sex with some men. But Donna follows her, and that sets Laura off because she wants to save her friend from this life that Laura's fallen into. Bob comes in through Laura's window to rape her later on, and she sees for the first time that it's actually her dad. Later, Laura has an orgy with Jock and Ronette and Leo, and her dad follows her and kidnaps her and Ronette to a train car. Ronette escapes, but Laura does not, and Leland carries her plastic-wrapped body away from the train car. We end with Laura and Agent Cooper comforting one another in the Black Lodge, while an angel bathes them in her light. Okay.
That's a great summary. That's an impossible movie to summarize, and yet you did. Very impressed. Yeah, one of the things that I was struck by watching it like the last few times, and especially this last time I watched it again yesterday, was, you know, I've not seen this done in other films. I mean, there's, you know, I think Brady Corbett does this a little bit with Vox Lux, where the lead character is in a different movie than everybody else, it seems. Like, she's giving a different performance of a different caliber, different tenor than everybody else in the film, who's naturalistic, and Natalie Portman is slightly more enhanced.
I'm, like, one of the few people who love that movie.
Yeah, yeah. I was wearing a T-shirt this morning when I was at the gym, so... yeah, anyway, so this movie, I find... spectacular and moving and very original in the way David Lynch did it, which is that Cheryl Lee, which is great, who, you know, is and was a great actress, very underused. Her emotions are so intense as Laura Palmer. She was almost like too big for TV, so she could never be in a TV show. She was always a dead corpse in the river.
Yes.
And like in this movie, she really gets to be Laura Palmer, fully inhabited. You know, she's 101%. She's, you know, she doesn't just inhabit the 90s. She inhabits the 1950s, the 1890s. I mean, she's like, her full bandwidth is so wide, and her range, her acting range. I mean, there's so much crying and so much hysterical laughing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, her feelings are so deep. And everybody else around her, like Bobby and James, I mean, they're both, like, her boyfriends are both limited. They're all living in a 50s movie, a TV sitcom, even like Dean Ashbrook, you know.
Yeah.
You know, maybe it's the way he was directed, but or maybe it was his you know, his range as an actor. I mean, David Lynch picked them for that specific thing, what they could do, and they did very well. They existed in a smaller bandwidth, and she had the full range, and she was in the wrong movie. I mean, this is the clearest way of conveying, like, somebody feeling they're in the wrong body, the wrong movie in their entire lives. I mean, surrounded by people in a different movie. You're just trapped. And I've never seen that. And I've, you know, there's a bit of that in The Truman Show, maybe. But this is like fully, fully blown. And the only person who matches her in intensity, who seems to be kind of on the same wavelength in the same kind of movie, is her father. I mean, that's like intensely tragic and intensely, I mean, it's a hugely, I don't know, it's deep and horrifying.
I mean, it, to me, it certainly does seem purposeful. I mean, for all the, it's, you know, a formalistic way of revealing her her outsiderness, for sure. It's not something that I immediately understood while watching it the first time. It was just like, what the fuck is going on?
Yeah. You know? Yeah. I mean, like, she just like, I mean, like, there was a lot of ugly crying by Laura Dern and Blue Velvet, which I still think is like one of the great, like, you know, like, ugly crying movies ever.
Yes.
But like, this is like next level, you know?
Yeah. And I think Cheryl Lee here, there's one scene in particular I can think of where you can tell, you know, when, you know, this isn't even a special scene. There's a scene where she's trying to manipulate Bobby. Bobby's like, maybe I won't come back to you. And then she's looking at him.
Yeah.
And her face slowly breaks out into a smile.
Yeah.
Because she's been like angry and frowning. And then it's just this very like slow creep of a smile on her face. And she's doing so much without saying anything at all.
Yeah. No, and it's amazing. And then that scene, like 10 minutes before the end, where she's like, I mean, maybe 20 minutes before the end, but 10 minutes before she gets killed, and she's like talking to James, I think, and she's like, you don't even know me, which is like the quintessential teenage line, you know. You don't even know me. Even Donna, my best friend, doesn't even know me. And it's like there is so much emotions, and yeah, I mean, there's so much in there.
I would like to talk about why David Lynch made this movie a little bit. He said, you know, because he had written things up to its lead, the lead up to its premiere at Cannes in 92. He said, this film is my cherry pie present to the fans of the show, however, one that's wrapped in barbed wire. Moreover, I happen to be in love with the characters of the show. I wanted to say goodbye to them symbolically. I realized instinctively that Laura Palmer's story wasn't yet told entirely. As a washed up corpse, she was the inner motivation of the show. I wanted to resurrect her, see her live, talk and move, but to prevent all mistakes, there won't be any new Twin Peaks episodes. This is the end. So,
Until you got much older, and then you wanted to document the feeling of being out of sorts and old, which is what season three is about.
Exactly, yeah. Right? So yeah. I think it's a really beautiful thing. I like that in 92 he was like, no, because honestly, I don't think there should have been new episodes at that time. I don't think it would have been
right. Yeah, he was like 40. He was in his mid-40s.
Well, the original idea, if they did get a season three for Twin Peaks, was that they would jump 10, 20 years ahead, even though it would only be 1 year later. That was their original idea. Yeah. So it's nice that it actually ended up happening like this.
It's really beautiful and it's so moving. You know, I mean, I'm not a kind of a, I mean, I love David Lynch. I love the elemental David Lynch. I'm not a fanatic in that. I don't know the names of all these, you know, subsidiary characters and all the theories. But I'm so moved by what he does.
I think with this character specifically, it makes me like him more as a filmmaker, that he was able to understand that this girl in this show that he had that was wildly popular never had a voice.
Yeah.
I'm interested in trying to relate this in some sense to you and the reason why you continued to tell your story through Shirkers. I mean, do you feel any kind of kinship in the way that, you know, David Lynch was like, I need to tell the story of this person who never got to talk, never got to say anything?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, the difference being it was me, my story, and I
You're
was
the corpse.
I was the corpse. And I was going to revisit and solve my own murder in making Shirkers, like the Shirkers I made that's just out.
Yeah.
That's about the Shirkers I made when I was a teenager.
Yes, because we should tell people that Shirkers was the title of the movie that she made when she was a teenager, but now she's also adopted that title for the release that is available on Netflix to watch.
Mm-hmm, just to confuse everyone even more.
Yes.
Also because it's, you know, Shirkers is such an unusual word and it works well on Google if you can spell it right. you know, those things matter. So this thing that happened so long ago, my friends that I've known in LA for 20 years, I've been here for a long time. Mm-hmm. You know, when you watch the movie, it dates me. So I could just say that I've been here a long time. And, you know, all my friends, like, they don't, like, when they saw this movie, they're like, they've known me 20 years. And I've actually never mentioned the Shirkers incident. And they were like, what? This happened to you? What the hell?
Were you like, you don't know me?
Yeah. I mean, I'm always, you don't know me. I mean, I'm always that. But it was like, you know, the film was the answer, you know, to all of that. And it was like an expression of who I was and who I've been and who I've hidden, you know, because there was no, you know, when you don't have proof that it ever happened, it just sounds like a tall tale. It just sounds like self-aggrandizement. Like, you made this crazy film with your friends when you were teenagers in Singapore and it got stolen from you by this mysterious guy. And then what? You know, you have no proof it ever happened, that you there was no proof that you shot in 100 locations with 100 extras and you had like the biggest dog on the island. And, you know, you sat on train tracks when the train, you know, you almost got killed by a train, and you hijacked buses and you stole old people out of old folks' home and put them in a scene and then took them back before they knew what happened. I mean, stuff like that. Nobody would believe it unless you had any proof. And so it was just a secret I buried. And I just became a different person.
They
grew up.
They were like the ripped pages out of your diary.
They are. And I was a different person. And having made the film and having reorganized my soul, I guess, I'm sort of a different person now.
We're going to take a quick break. And then when we come back, we're going to talk about a little bit of the idea of using the subconscious to create narrative and, you know, how David Lynch makes his nightmare escapes. One quick break.
Hi, I'm Joe Firestone.
And I'm Manolo Moreno.
And we're the hosts of Dr. Game Show, which is a podcast where we play games submitted by listeners, regardless of quality or content, with in-studio guests and callers from all over the world.
And you can win a custom magnet. Subscribe now to make sure you get our next episode.
What's an example of a game, Manolo?
Pokemon or medication.
How do you play that?
You have to guess if something's a Pokemon name or a medication.
Medication.
First-time listener, if you want to listen to episode highlights and also know how to participate, follow Dr. Game Show on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
We'd love to hear
from
you.
It's really fun.
For the whole family, we'll be every other Wednesday starting March 13th, and we're coming to Max Fun!
Snorlax.
Pokemon?
Yes.
Nice.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined here today by Sandy Tan, and we're talking about Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me. I would like to share a little bit of another quote that David Lynch has about the creation of this movie. He said, quote, "Everyone wants to know what the Red Room in Twin Peaks stands for that appears again in the movie. Even I don't know what exactly means. I can still remember, well, when I've had this idea, but I don't know why. From a rational point of view, I can see that I used a similar pattern as the one in the attic before an eraser head. However, everything else was just a matter of inspiration. The red curtains, the stylized design, the dancing dwarf. Even if I wanted to, I wouldn't be able to explain their meaning because intuition is irrational." This is something that he talks about quite a bit.
Yeah.
Where people want to know the meanings of things. They want to do a connection. Mm-hmm. But in essence, what that's doing is, you know, it's he doesn't know, but it's mining his subconscious.
Yeah.
You know, people want to know more about him and what he thinks because he's not making these conscious choices necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I find that fascinating because this whole film, all of Twin Peaks, Fire Walk With Me, feels like intuition.
Yeah, and that's why it's so deep, and that's why when you watch it, it sears into your, not your brain, past your brain, it goes into your soul and just kind of grabs you and just sucks you in. Like, you know, when Laura's given this picture of this door and that she hangs on the wall, and then, you know, she starts to dream and see herself in that picture opening the door and going through it and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, it's stuff we, you know, you know, he's mining, well, I guess David Lynch is mining his own dreams, but it's everybody's dreams. I mean, these are the motifs that everyone sees. It's, you know, it's mm-hmm. pretty universal. So he gets at something really deep beyond conventional, you know, story structure.
That's something that I read obviously a lot about David Lynch because I want to understand him.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not adept at writing about him. I
yeah.
know that much about myself. But I do know that there is the idea that symbolic order supersedes clear narrative logic, especially
mm-hmm.
in this. And so I'd like to talk about what symbolic order might mean for this or for your work, too. Because
mm-hmm.
if you watch Shirkers...
Yeah.
The original film that was made when you were a teenager in Singapore does have a kind of associative logic to it, where there is a character and stuff, but then things kind of happen.
Yeah. I should say what the original movie was about. The one that I made as a teenager in 1992 in Singapore with my friends, I wrote the script and we shot the first draft, mm-hmm. I have to tell you. And it was about a killer, a teenage 16-year-old killer named S., and I played that S. And she was going around Singapore to she's auditioning five people. She's looking for five people to be in her tribe, and she's going to kill them and take them along with her to the other world or something. It's like, you know, it's an excuse really for a road movie,
mm-hmm.
An impossible road movie that was going to happen in the smallest country in the world, which is like this little island of Singapore, which is like a fifth the size of Rhode Island. You
mm-hmm.
can cross it in 40 minutes. And she was going to, you know, travel to all these, you know, all these funny locations and find all these funny looking people. Some of whom were very talented actors, and like, you know, kill the five best ones and take them along with her. It was like it was an excuse to show things that were that,
yeah,
that
all the people and yeah. places that you can, mm-hmm. you know, it really did seem like you were like, I need to put this location in, this person in, this
yeah.
location, this
before
person.
Everything vanished, you know,
mm-hmm.
and everyone died.
Yeah, so there. You know, like, narrative logic is not necessarily
no.
the prominent feature of that, nor is it in Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me. So what does symbolic order mean to you? Like, what does that, like, how, because when I'm thinking about Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me, it's something about kind of primal
mm-hmm.
Symbols that somehow mean something to me that I
mm-hmm.
don't know that they mean, that give me some sense that I feel grounded in this narrative.
Hmm. So with Shirkers, I mean, S, the heroine, she has a game board that you know, that I made up. And, you know, there's like pieces on it, and she's one of the game pieces. And
mm-hmm.
the various people in her life are various little symbols on this game board. And
yeah.
she kind of moves them on and off depending on whether she intends to kill them or not, whether then the, and you know, within the five she was going to take along with her to the next world.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, in terms of symbols, I wasn't really thinking that hard, I don't think.
No, I mean, that's what David Lynch is saying. Yeah. Like, you're not thinking about that, but you might just put it in because you're like, this is...
Yeah. Yeah, and I did have a great attraction to the black and white motif. I mean, I think a lot of people do who kind of are doing graphically striking design. You mm-hmm. kind of get into the black and white squares or zigzags and things like that. So we had a bit of that. And like a lot of people who found the film online, you know, wrote about it and said that it was kind of Wes Andersonian rather than Lynch, even though maybe Lynch might have been my godfather in my own head. But, you know, and of course, like when we made the film in 1982, Wes Anderson hadn't actually made Bottle Rocket or any of his iconic films yet. So it's a strange confluence of, I don't know, the collective unconscious or something, like the fact that so much of, I mean, some frames, a lot of frames in the film actually resemble things in Wes Anderson's work, you know. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there's some unconscious that's going on or you know, symbols that's happening.
I like the idea of the collective unconscious because, you know, I think that there's certain filmmakers of their time who are able to tap into those things.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's like what I was saying with like primal symbols, things where it's just like, you don't know, you know, like it's strong enough or it evokes a feeling enough where even just something very small, a game board would do that for someone because everyone knows what a game board is. You have some kind of feeling about what that is.
Yeah.
A diary mm-hmm. and a Firewalk with Me. We know that like someone ripped pages out of a diary is mm-hmm. a violation. You know, you're bringing up some things about, you know, mood, ambiance and getting away with techniques and stories and characters that mm-hmm. you wouldn't normally be able to in other ways. So I think it's a good time for us to kind of switch into maybe discussing the surreality mm-hmm. of this movie.
Yeah.
Or, you know, what is we lazily refer to as surreality. Cam Collins from, he was writing for The Ringer. He wrote a really beautiful piece on remembering Firewalk with Me, and I wanted to mm-hmm. to quote something from that. He said, "Then again, this all pretends that discussing Lynch in terms of the surreal isn't already kind of boring and insufficient, which of course it is. The term is so often deployed in assessments of his work that it's become shorthand for a bunch of qualities we don't otherwise seem to have a language for. So we repeat the same words, dreamlike soap opera, nightmare, noir procedural. Surreal is the most abused descriptor of all, followed by Lynchian, another term I hate. It's redundant when referring to Lynch and embarrassingly generous when referring to anyone else.
Yeah.
Even Lynch seems to think the term doesn't quite hit the mark." And then he's got a quote from Lynch that says, "I love the surrealists and I sort of understand what people are saying, but I just think that maybe things aren't always surreal. To me, a story can be both concrete and abstract, or a concrete story can hold abstractions. And abstractions are things that really can't be said so well with words. They're intuited. They're understood in a different way." Mm-hmm. So what does that mean to you?
You know, like the feelings that those images, the combination of images, editing, and sound. I mean, sound is such a huge part of, like, just the sound of static, you know, that evokes something for you. Rumblings that he uses a lot of that evoke something else. And he doesn't use them in the usual way. He uses them in a much more instinctive way. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, when you actually are very close and you listen to what is instinctively correct rather than what is textbook storytelling wise correct, then you are able to create something that seems new and feels completely direct to your soul. I don't know. I think that he's very inspiring in that use of technique, I guess.
It's almost impossible to talk or write about David Lynch, mm-hmm. which makes people want to write or talk about him
really
more. It feels like, because we can't find the words just to describe what
his
stuff
is. You just have
is.
To watch it and then feel it.
Yeah. But then trying to so you see a lot, I think people have gravitated towards the idea of kind of writing about the personal or the self when watching it, because they are trying to describe the feeling in criticism rather than.
Yeah. For me, the impressive thing is the way he kind of seems to be able to create like the experiential feeling of like the last moments of her life. You know, mm-hmm. and one of the most intense things I've ever seen in the movies, I think, was her kind of like saying, "You don't understand me," to the boy, James, and then runs off and says, "I love you," and then runs off into the woods and has that party with those horrible people and then eventually gets killed. And the murder scene is like one of the most harrowing scenes ever, because I keep thinking she's gonna, like, every time I watch it, it's so weird to think that I know this movie, I've lived it. It's like you've, and yet you think she's gonna escape. There's this some way, because she's living as if she's gonna escape, and she wants to fight for her life, and mm-hmm. you think you're rooting for her so hard that as you're watching, you still believe she's gonna leave that room, and when she doesn't, and she gets it, because everyone is playing that part so intensely and so, I don't know, emotionally real, I guess, yeah. about it with this. I mean, it sounds so stupid, you know, talking about it like that. It's really hard to kind of put into words unless you actually watch this thing, the way yeah. sound and images and editing come together. That crazed look in Ray Wise's, you know, in his eyes.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, when he kills his own daughter, it's just like, I don't know, you feel like she's going to escape that, and yet she doesn't. And when she gets it, it feels like a real intense kind of death. I mean, it feels final. And then, and horrifyingly tragic. And then when she's when you see her in that room after her death, mm-hmm. It feels like such a relief. I mean, you see her with kind of like corpse like makeup, you know, kind yeah. of mortician makeup, and then you don't know what she's feeling. She's unreadable at that moment. Before she kind of breaks into a laugh, and before she breaks into any kind of emotions, her face is kind of blank and it's hard to read, and she's just still kind of processing death.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, him capturing that whole process, I don't think I've actually seen that, you know, in any movie that traces the path from life to, you know, being actually killed to dying. And then, I mean, I think Enter the Void by Gaspar Noé has a bit of that, maybe. Mm. But this really, you're facing it head on and you're feeling it. And there's something to do with, I guess, what you're just talking about with, his techniques and his...
I mean, there's a certain sense of, you know, when this premiered at Cannes, there were journalists who said, so we're watching this movie to wait until she dies. And so people were disappointed. Mm-hmm. Not as disappointed as the rumors always say.
Yeah.
It was just, you know, like a few people who were just like why are we watching this? You know,
yeah.
like, you know, we're just waiting for her to die. But that doesn't seem to me like the case for it, you know, because it's like
the release too.
Yeah, it
is. It's the release.
I mean,
the 3 minutes in which she, you know, processes this thing and then sort of laughs and cries and, you know, and you know, like, returns to this image that mattered to her when she was alive, which you had seen earlier, which is the angel that she had this kind of picture on the wall of this angel, this kind of cliched, you know, white robed person with wings. And then she sees this thing after she's dead, and she kind of seeks she just feels relieved in
yeah.
seeing it. And this is what religion is, I guess. And you feel her relief because you've seen her see that image before. And so it's he tracks the experiences so well. He plants it before and then he pays it off later. And you do feel her progress as a person who's, you know, dying and dead and then, you know, being somehow, resolved at the end. And it's very deep, you know.
Yeah. And David Lynch believes in angels.
Yeah,
it's like a
yeah,
he very much believes in them.
But when you trace those things, it's you really feel it as a film viewer, and I think that's unusual.
We're gonna take one quick break, and when we come back, we're gonna talk a little bit about the writing process that Bob Engel and David Lynch had. Okay, we'll be right back.
Hello, I'm Oliver Wong, scholar, journalist, and DJ.
And I'm Morgan Rhodes. I'm a music supervisor. We host Heat Rocks, a podcast where we invite our favorite musicians, writers, and scholars to talk about the albums that have changed their lives. Join us as we discover forgotten classics.
I think that Boots Riley is one of, if not the most underrated MCs in the history of hip-hop.
Reminisce about our faves.
I was always feeling like a little bit of a tourist when I would listen to like Big Daddy Kane. And suddenly when De La Soul came out, it was like, hey, you can dance and be goofy and have fun and love hip-hop, and you don't have to pretend to be anybody but yourself.
And of course, talk nonstop about his Purple Majesty, Prince.
Having your idol listen to your music, it's life-changing. It's the thing you want from your parents, so to speak, or that you didn't have.
Heat Rocks, every Thursday here on Maximum Fun.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined here today by Sandy Tan. And we are talking about Twin Peaks, Firewalk with Me. So Bob Engel had some really great things to say about how this all came together. The first thing that he said, though, was that they were just kind of throwing every single thing in that they could think of because they felt like this was a really freeing kind of activity. And they were like, we're not even going to think about paring it down. We're just going to put everything in that we possibly can. And apparently it was 181 pages, and they were like actually considering, can we put an intermission in this? Can we shoot all of this and put an intermission in? And they did end up paring it down, which is amazing when you think of the fact that like the finished product is like 130 some minutes, and then you have the, you know, however, like almost 100 minutes of footage that they have that they put in the Blu-ray, the Criterion. Yeah. So they shot, 235 minutes, something around there.
Yeah, that's a lot of stuff. I mean, a lot of good stuff.
And so that's all pared down. And yet, so there's just so many things that they had to cut. And for them, it was, I think, really difficult. He said, Bob Engel said, things just got cut. We spent a day shooting the scenes in Argentina, and those didn't even make the film either. New Line told us the film was too long. There's not much mystery there and why we had to cut it.
Yeah, there was not much mystery. There was a lot of emotions. Like if you watch The Missing Pieces, like it's held together by the safety pins that are, emotions. And so it kind of holds you as a movie through some kind of strange, I don't know, psychic sense rather than some plot sense. But it does hold together as a movie, which I find remarkable that all these kind of, cast off B cuts were just like they hold together as a film in itself. I find that remarkable.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, the emotional resonance. I remember that there's one scene from that where I think Bobby and his family, they're like praying at the table or something. I can't remember, but there's like a lot of prayer. There's just kind of like ritualistic things and stuff that kind of sparks, like if you just kind of sparks very deeper feelings of just like, I remember something like that. Mm-hmm. You just have like a kind of
vestigial.
The vestigial, like just memory of something that, whether it was from your childhood, he's pulling at those strings.
Oh, yeah. He's very in touch with all those things. I mean, that's the thing about Lynch. He's so in touch with his younger self, the kid, who plays the boy with the without a face or the boy with a mask.
Yes.
I mean, like, that's clearly the young version of him, like modeled down to, I mean, like, down to the haircut and the way that the shirt's buttoned all the way to the top and all that. I mean, it's just like he's so in touch with that person. That person is still very much a part of him.
I think it's a very difficult thing to have a filmmaker be an adult and still be in touch with that, because I do think that we kind of naturally lose it. I'm trying to think, like, I think just the guy who made Houssou is like the only other person I can think of who was able to tap into that kind
or you make a film like I did, and in the process of making this film and finishing the film, I actually kind of revitalize and resuscitate and kind of reanimated the dead teenager part of me, and then that person's part of me again, and I feel it's like I'm now two people, and it's fine.
It's like going back into your diaries, going back into, like if you were five or something, doing like psychoanalytic work or something.
Yeah,
like
I think that Lynch is, in touch with all those parts of him at every point, it seems like, which is why his stuff is so unique. It requires that he does not make a Marvel movie, though. He will have to lose a lot of him.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he always talks a lot about Dune is probably the closest thing that he's going to make to a Marvel movie. But he always said that Dune was a failure to him because he didn't feel like he made Dune the way that he should have.
Yeah.
But he always knew, even if the reception to Twin Peaks Fire Walk with Me was not warm, he knew that this was not a failure to him.
Yeah.
Because it was the movie that he wanted to make.
It's authentic to him.
And it's what he wanted. And he did everything that he could for it. And so
it's very admirable. It's something that all filmmakers should, filmmakers who want to aspire to that should remember.
Yeah. He said, quote, there's this thing, there's this donut, and there's the hole. And we should keep our eye on the donut, not on the hole.
That's really good. It's profound.
It's so simple, so profound. That's our guy. I want to talk about the fact that this movie has kind of a lack of humor to
it. Really?
Like, and I mean, we're comparing it to The Show. So it's slightly...
Oh, you mean goofball. Well, that's why I think they had the first 35 minutes. You know, there's a bit of goofball stuff in there when he... there's like the, I don't know, the hijinks when they come into the office, and there's the... I don't remember the names, but the ranger and his wife. And
oh, yeah.
And they're like laughing and just being goofy. And there's, you know, all these like little bits of goofy bits.
Which is almost like a segue from the TV show. Because then they're like, we're not going to have that when Laura shows up.
Yeah.
Like, that's not going to be here anymore.
Yeah. It's different. Yeah.
The Robbie Collin, writing for The Guardian, suggested, quote, the investigation into Laura's death may have unfolded with the airy open-endedness of a daydream, mm-hmm. but her death itself had to be a waking nightmare, which I would agree with. I think that it would have been, had it been humorous in the way that the show was, I would have felt like...
It's a betrayal.
Yeah, it is betrayal
to her
character.
Because she's going to die.
Yeah. Your film has a mix of humor and kind of like a serious meditation in it, mm-hmm. too. Were there times if you felt like maybe you wanted to make something humorous and it was a bad idea, you know, like you just needed to like make it serious, or were there times where you were trying to navigate that yourself?
Yeah, the lucky thing for me was that I didn't have a producer breathing down my neck. It was just me, which is horrible, too. But I didn't have anyone to answer to in that way. And so I just could be very authentic to what I wanted to be at every point. And mm-hmm. so for me to, I started the movie kind of in a more humorous sense as an 18-year-old who's like had his brimming with ideas. So it was much more playful, and the music and, you know, editing and the kind of graphics we had around us mm-hmm. were just like a lot funnier. And then as things happen to you that weren't so funny, you have to, you know, kind of reflect try to replicate the experiential aspect of what went through, what I went through.
Yeah.
And in order to take people along this journey with me, I had to kind of replicate that. So if it wasn't going to be funny, it wasn't going to be funny on the film.
Yeah. There's a sense that if it's about you, I don't know how you are with me, but like as my defense mechanism, if something hurts me, I try to make a joke out of it.
Yeah. And I mean, there are like little bits of jokes I you know, like have elsewhere. And there's always like strange humor, even amidst tragedy and uncanny and creepy situations. Mm-hmm. There's always a bit of humor. And you just make sure that those are reflected, because the people around you that you talk to, and that yourself. I mean, you might I don't know. There's always like, I don't know, like remembering things, and I guess it's even when things are really creepy, that at least in the case of my movie, they were slightly funny.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but you have to balance those. Like
it takes some. I guess you have to be just very attuned to what you're. Your gut feel. I mean, I just completely always listen to my gut. If my skin crawls, it's just creepy or too desperate or just yucky, I just remove it. And the wonderful thing about editing is you can just like tear things apart and just put them together in like 5 seconds.
I wanted to get into a little bit about telling stories about the bad guys. In this case, I'll go back to another quote that David Lynch had when he was writing about this film before it premiered at Cannes. He said, I'm tired about the perpetual arguing about the alleged brutality in my films. Violence exists in our world, and you can't simply ignore it. You have to show it, especially if you want to tell powerful stories, as I want to. Those who only want to tell about the joys of being and the art of picking cherries shouldn't start making films at all, because good people are boring. Only the bad guys have style.
I agree with that. And Laura Palmer is not entirely a good guy. You know, like she's, her desires are so beyond good and evil or bad. She's not a bad, I mean, she's a good girl and a bad girl. I mean, she's both. She's everything.
Yeah.
Which makes her so compelling and interesting.
Meals and wheels, but doing coke, you know?
And coke is not necessarily a bad,
let's leave this podcast talking about whether or not coke is good.
but it's like she hurts people along the way. Maybe that's a bad thing. And she leads her best friend, who's really innocent, astray, and you know, her best friend wanting to be like her and do all those things that she's not quite psychologically prepared for, might be a bad thing, and hurting people and you know whatever. Mm-hmm. But she's you know, that's why she's so compelling, because she's not just a good thing.
Yeah, and at the same time, we've got Ray Wise's character Leland Palmer, mm-hmm. who is, you know, a terrifying soul and very, you know, just so scary.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, he is, I think, one of people's favorite characters of Twin Peaks, though, and he is the guy who murdered his own
daughter
after raping her.
He's a goofball, and I don't know. I think it's more tragic because of that.
Yeah, that we like him.
And he's completely, you know, neutered and diffused and just seems like a funny guy. You don't think that was ever going to do anything. I mean, you know, potentially because he's got that face eyes. But it's like tapping to untapped potential in the series. Like, this is the movie version we're going to show you.
Mm-hmm. And the performance that he gives specifically, there's him, oh God, which one is it? Oh, when he sees Laura Palmer, his daughter, on the bed, and he's supposed to, you know, have sex with these women, and she, you know, his daughter turns out to be one. Mm-hmm. He's like walking back, and he has this very kind of like angry, kind of rupturous thing that happens to him so often in this film that I'm just, I mean...
Which is why they're in the same movie. Like, he and his daughter are the only people in that kind of movie with those kinds of emotions. Everybody else is on a different register, like smaller bandwidth. These people have a much wider bandwidth. And when you're watching it, it's so clear they're kind of kin.
Yeah.
You know, it's so tragic that they're bound in this horrifying way.
Yeah.
But that's the logic of that is like really clear when you're watching it. It's an emotional logic.
I do think it's interesting because like... you know, in the TV show, we have an ensemble cast, right? Mm-hmm. To me, there doesn't seem to be any kind of, you know, argument about the fact that Laura and Leland are the main characters and that, you know, they are the ones that we should be paying attention to, even though there are scenes where other characters are alone. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I do wonder if that is maybe part of their kind of acting differently and other people being a little bit slower, a little bit kind of dumber. And, you know, just the fact that, like, we know that our focus is pulled to these two characters very specifically.
Yeah, it's amazing. Like, amazing skill to just kind of, have the actors and the performances be the pull rather than, you know, focus and camera and shots, like showing you who to put your eyes and your, you know, hearts towards. It's the thing themselves.
Yeah.
It's very new. I mean, I think, you know, very few people do that still. It's a kind of very interesting thing to think about as a director. You know, this is what, you know, another kind of meta technique that's not a technique in terms of editing or anything you can do in the computers, but something like just completely organic and to the thing itself.
I'm curious, you know, we were talking about like the bad guys and telling stories about the bad guys. Mm. How did you feel about telling a story about a quote unquote bad guy? Because this is, and I'm talking about not necessarily even just your director, but also like a little bit yourself.
Yeah.
You kind of paint yourself and not the brightest light in your own movie.
Honesty, I guess. I didn't see George Cardona, the guy who stole my film from me and caused me to kind of go into a funk for
you
a
know,
long.
An adult who was overseeing these young people.
Yeah, he was in his 40s and we were teenagers and he was the authority figure, I guess. He was my mentor, my best friend, and then he kind of stole the film away from us and, you know, caused this black hole in our lives and my life for decades. And I just, you know, the strange thing is in making the film, I just don't see him as a villain. It's like people find it really strange that I'm not angrier. Maybe I had been angry. I'd gone through all those phases. It's the process of me piecing together this jigsaw puzzle of my life that I realized that he's much more complicated than that. If I reduce him to a villain, I'm actually doing a disservice to myself because it's kind of negating the fact that he had once been my best friend. I was not a dumb kid. I didn't just willingly let this kind of wolf into my, like, I don't know, my innocent lamb life. You know, I went in like, you know, fully cognizant of the fact that he may not be the best. You know, he wasn't a complete truth teller, but he was the most interesting person who saw me as an artist who had stories to tell and, you know, who kind of saw me as a human. Mm-hmm. And that was gratifying in its own. And he actually expanded my world. He was a great mentor. He, you know, we talked about the French New Wave. We really got into movies. I really got into movies big. at that point. So to kind of paint him as a villain and just like discard him as you're discarding that younger you as well and your instincts at that point. But to kind of embrace him as nemesis, that's different. And you have then you're placing yourself as an equal, and you can treat him as an equal. And he's a much more compelling subject.
Yeah. Nemesis instead of a villain. I like that.
Yeah.
I think that kind of denying those binaries is probably pretty important. And it's also important to what we have with David Lynch, too, because there is no complete evil except for Bob, you know? Like, that's the... And even that entity, like the Black Lodge, has some kind of weird goodness inside of it. Like, there's an angel that exists in this area. You know, like, there's... Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're... And, you know, Laura and Leland, they are... adversaries in a sense.
Yeah, they are. Yep.
Laura is both victim but also
enabler in some strange ways, because she put herself in that situation where, you know,
she's like a, I don't know, she's a very kind of strong heroine in a sense though too.
Yeah. Because she was trying to escape that movie that she's trapped in. That's the wrong movie that she was not made for. And she does all she can. Like, she goes, you know, she does drugs. She does all these things to kind of escape those bounds. And yet she's still caught in it. And then finally she meets her match, which is tragically the other person who's also caught in the wrong movie, who's her dad.
Damn. And your match was your director, George.
Yeah. It's a strange... you know, strange.
A lot of parallels here, Sandy.
And now you see why I picked this film.
Yes, I do.
Even though I'm unable to speak about it too lucidly, because it's really hard to talk about.
Well, you know, it's not a lucid movie. Thank you so much for coming in and chatting with me.
Oh, this is great fun.
And people can see Shirkers on Netflix right now, right?
Yes, they can.
Anytime.
In any format in your phone, in any language. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Switchblade Sisters. And if you like what you're hearing, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. If you do, we'll read it on air. Morgantown Global Fungi has a review. They say, I wish I could remember which podcast introduced me to Switchblade Sisters. I am so grateful you are in my ears. Your interview style, incorporating your guest's favorite movie with her current or previous project, is solid gold. Never the same, never feels formulaic. Your research, more conversation than interview, the fandom, and your camaraderie with their guests are so fluid and effortless, I feel like I'm sitting with two longtime friends. I came to hear about a classic movie I love, I stayed and learned about some amazing women in the movie industry. Brilliant and fun, Rob B., PhD, Morgantown. Oh, we got a PhD! Morgantown, West Virginia. Ooh! Okay, so then we've got JHC and TF Hota. Who says, this is such a film lover's format and such a smart way to get at filmmakers' passion and inspiration for their work. It's a great way to launch a conversation and get insight into filmmaking and filmmakers. Great idea by film critic and host April Wolf. That's me. I love the most recent episode where Demaine Davis discusses The Wiz. I did also. If you want to let us know what you think of the show, you can tweet at us at SwitchbladePod or email us at SwitchbladeSisters@MaximumFun.org. Please check out our Facebook group. That's Facebook.com/groups/SwitchbladeSisters. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of MaximumFun.org.
These hands are filthy.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.